This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today by remembering and a warning. We are about to have a conversation about the Holocaust. Today is the day when people across the world are called to remember the Holocaust. Between 1933 and 1945, 6 million Jewish people were persecuted and killed by Nazi Germany. And Miriam Kaur was one of them. She and her twin sister, Eva, were in a concentration camp together. Here's Eva talking to 60 Minutes journalist Leslie Stahl about it.
How old were you when you went to Auschwitz?
When I arrived in Auschwitz, I was 10 years old.
So here's the thing. Eva died a year before Stahl asked her that question. Stahl's actually talking to an AI hologram of Eva. Her story of survival is just one of many collected by the USC Shoah Foundation. It's a race against time to preserve these firsthand experiences some 90 years after the Holocaust. Well, now Boston has a new Holocaust Museum in the works. Plans are for it to open in 2025. And this week in Miami, survivor David Schachter is answering questions and filming a hologram for that museum. Here to talk about it, Jody Kipnis, co-founder of the Boston Holocaust Museum, and Corey Street, deputy executive director of the USC Shoah Foundation. Jody, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And Corey, welcome to you as well.
Good morning. Thanks for allowing me to join.
I want to center David Schachter's voice right away here. So here is some sound. This came from WLRN reporter Veronica Zaragovia, who spoke with Schachter this month about the taping that's happening today, actually, the last day in Miami. Here is Schachter.
And this is what I think I was destined to do. I want these children to become my mouthpiece. I want them to tell the story that they heard me telling them when I'm no longer. And that's my purpose. And that's what I am. That's what gives me strength.
David's in his 90s. Corey, tell us a little bit about David Schachter and the story he's telling this week.
Well, I mean, David's story is so powerful, but I mean, I defer that one to Jody. I mean, Jody, like, this story is going to be central to this new museum, and you know David's story, so well. But I think, I mean, we're just so excited to bring him into the collection. I think his unique perspective, particularly that we're able to take it now with all that's going on today, the rise of anti-Semitism, is going to make this one, a phenomenal addition. And Jody, we just thank you so much for the new museum partnering with us.
And Jody, as you tell us a little more about David, you know, include in the story the trip that he took you on that led you to wanting to make sure that there was a Holocaust Museum in Boston.
Yeah, absolutely. We are so blessed to have known David. Todd Ruderman and I, who he's my co-founder in the Holocaust Legacy Foundation. And really, we went away with David. David reached out to us, invited us on March of the Living, and we went to Auschwitz with him. We stood right in front of his bunker, number 8. And those words that you heard him say about being his mouthpiece is exactly what he said to us. He was able to tell us what he saw there, what he heard. The one thing he said to us was, you would never get the scent, of what I smelled. And I'll tell you, it hit Todd and I really hard when we, on our return home, actually, on the plane, on a cocktail napkin, we started to devise a fellowship. Took 16 teens away. We realized over our lifetime that we wouldn't be able to impact as many people or teenagers as we thought we could. So David survived Auschwitz. He went there with his brother. He then went on to Buchenwald. While in Buchenwald, he lost his brother. He was shot by a Nazi on their way to work. David cleaned the cattle cars, and David feels it was his brother is the reason he survived. His David should have gone into selection and should have gone to the gas chambers. One of the interesting things that we did find out about David, and it's interesting that it was so close to, you know, Martin Luther King Day, Jr. Day, and then having our new memorial on Boston Commons, the new thing we found out from David, with one of the great questions that have been asked by the Shoah Foundation, was David told everybody he actually walked with Martin Luther King Jr. So that was pretty interesting.
So let me jump in here. And again, just resetting for our listeners who may just be joining us, we're talking with Jody Kipnis and Corey Street about the development of a new Holocaust museum here in Boston and filming of survivors to create interactive holographs that will keep history living. And we are talking about the Holocaust in this segment. So be aware of that. Corey, I'll come back to you. One of the things the Shoah Foundation has done is bring these interactive holograms. And we've talked a lot about AI, artificial intelligence, here on Radio Boston over the last several months. And, you know, it's we've had some uncomfortable conversations about what it can do. But this is a very different and very powerful form of discomfort, which is to make sure that those firsthand voices, which are always the way to keep us from denying the enormity of something terrible that's happened, will always respond and talk and answer and live. That is pretty incredible.
It is. I mean, we've been working on what we're seeing today since 2011. Like it was really the, you know, working with the Institute of Creative Technologies and Conscious Display and USC Shoah Foundation in 2011, 2012, where we started to think about how these new emerging technologies, both in film capture as well as in film production, could help us deal with the looming loss of survivors being able to go into a classroom and for young people to have those powerful conversations, to leverage their own curiosity, to find their way to how the Holocaust is still relevant. And so using AI and machine learning, we're able to take what is a testimony, and this is very important to us, that we're not, you know, curating this. We're not, you know, polishing it up. This is David's testimony. We're asking him, you know, between 700 and 1100 questions, and you as a user will be able to find your way through his testimony to learn from him long after he's able to be present with you, whether that's, you know, if he's not, you know, in Boston that day and you come into the museum, you'll be able to have those conversations because of the technology. And so it approximates that ability. But because of the new filming techniques, it looks so lifelike that people forget they're talking to a pre-recorded testimony.
It does. I mean, so the filming, there are a couple of different techniques, and it's in front of a green screen. But when you see the final product, it really has a very, you know, 3D, not that filmy Iron Man thing, right? It's a very, you feel you're like you're talking to someone.
It has depth. It has depth in the conversation, but it has depth in the experience.
Yeah. So I want to pick up there. I'm going to play a couple of pieces of sound here. First, Fred Wasserman, who is the acquisitions curator for the National Institute for Holocaust Documentation of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. He was talking in March 22 about the urgency of this moment.
The survivor generation, the eyewitnesses themselves, some 75 years plus after the war, they're a generation that are dwindling and they are, you know, they're passing. And they are our most direct connection to their own experiences.
And Jody Kipnis, I'm going to bring you a second piece of sound here. This is former Boston City Councilor Mike Ross. His father, Stephen, was a Holocaust survivor. And here he is talking about why it's important to him to preserve Holocaust artifacts.
The reason why it's so important to do all this stuff is because some of this has to do with evidence of the worst crime perpetrated against by humans, against humans in the history of mankind. So in some ways, this is evidence of a crime. And it's coming at a time when people are saying the Holocaust never happened, that for whatever reason, you have people who are denying that the Holocaust even happened. And you have the rise of hate crimes and anti-Semitic crimes throughout the world.
Jody, according to the Anti-Defamation League of New England, anti-Semitic incidents increased by 42% in 2021 over 2020. And I am mindful that the Nazis killed a wide range of people in the Holocaust, including more than 6 million members of the Jewish population. How important is it as you bring a museum, right, between the Holocaust Memorial and the Freedom Trail to the heart of Boston, that these firsthand stories are the way that we keep the reality of what happened present for young people?
Look, you know, when you're looking at millions, those numbers are a statistic, you know, but when you take one story, just one story can educate, you know, what everybody's saying is that we're in a point in time when we're moving from living memory to historical memory, which makes what the USC Shoah Foundation so important, you know, because my kids' generation, fortunate enough to meet Holocaust survivors, but our children's, my children's children's, you know, generation, my grandchildren will not. And this is going to be the closest that they're going to get to hearing directly those stories. And as you said, you know, being in Boston, such a diverse community that we live in, and there are so many other genocides, and we will touch on all of them.
So I want to, I'm thinking now, and so, Jody, you talked at the beginning about being in Auschwitz, being in Germany, excuse me, Poland, with David Schachter, and him explaining to you that there was one thing he experienced, which was the smell. That was something that you wouldn't be able to, but somehow that brought it home for you. And I'm imagining, Corey, the questions that people will ask, the little details that they'll want to know about. The way you're doing this, the more than 1,000 questions that David Schachter is down in Miami answering today, he'll be able to tell that story with however people come to it with their own curiosity. Am I right, Corey?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you do this in your work. Stories connect us. So hearing an authentic story from another human being is what's going to connect us to these issues. It's what's going to connect us and realize that we have a responsibility to counter hatred. So David can talk about the smell. He can talk about how it felt when his brother was shot. He can talk about how it felt to be the person in that cattle car. And in that, it brings all of that other big information, all of the text information, to a human space. So not only are we able to talk to people intellectually, so I guess get them at the head, but we can affect them cognitively and get them at the heart with this story.
Jody, what kind of reception are you getting in the community here in Boston as you fundraise for this, prepare for this, tell people how you're going about creating these living stories for the museum?
So I haven't been home yet. I have been here in Florida preparing for the filming that we've been doing all week since January 5th. Very excited to come home to Boston tonight. But, you know, people have been hearing about it on the radio, on social media. People are really, really excited about it. They haven't seen it yet really to understand it. And I know we call it a hologram, and it really isn't truly a hologram. It's more of this, it's the same technology, that a very similar technology that they use that made like Michael Jackson come to life. And I know Corey could explain that a little bit better. But everybody is just excited about the museum itself coming there. I think it'll make a big new addition, a wonderful addition to the city. And look, for us, our main goal is that every student in all of New England makes it through that museum before they graduate. And if we can touch one kid, we've touched one kid.
All right. Jody Kipnis is co-founder of the Boston Holocaust Museum, and Corey Street is deputy executive director of the USC Shoah Foundation. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
My heart is happy because once a month, our friend and neighbor and Boston culinary rock star, Tiffany Faison, drops by, and she is doing that right now here in Studio 2.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Tiziana?
I'm doing very well. I have so many questions for you today.
I'm here for it. All the questions.
And I got a little bit of a theme for us today because we've been talking a bunch on the show, Tiffany, over the last few weeks, in for different reasons at different times, about food and how expensive it is, and how to eat well and eat happy,
yeah.
feed your body and feed your soul, mm-hmm. and not break the bank.
Hard right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's challenging.
So I'm hoping that's one of the things that we can talk about today.
Yes, I would love to talk about that.
And I'm wondering if that is something that you're kind of seeing. Okay, so like we know how that affects the average person's
sure.
pocketbook.
Sure, yeah.
How does it affect the chef and restaurant's pocketbook?
It's interesting because I think that there's maybe like an assumption in the world that we have things figured out in restaurants where we get like cheaper food or we have better deals on food, and we don't. That's not true for us at all. It's never been true. And typically the higher quality the food, the more expensive it becomes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we're feeling it. Everyone's feeling it. You're feeling it at the grocery stores. You're feeling it at farmers markets. You're feeling it in restaurants. I mean, a case of romaine for me used to be, and this is a commodity romaine. We're not talking like the most exquisite organic.
Artisanal fancy
Yeah, exactly. This is like run-of-the-mill romaine. Used to walk in at $36 a case and it's $122 right
now.
Oh
my gosh.
So when people talk about the price of a burger, it's not just like what is the price of the meat. My romaine's gone up. I mean, it's unbelievable. And that's everything. So it's tough. It's really tough. And so, I do think the perception is like when I go to restaurants, restaurant prices should stay the same. But when I'm at the grocery store, the prices are so much more than they used to be. So we all feel it. As we know, restaurants are a business of like really slim margins. We can't step over dimes to get to dollars. So I think there's an opportunity for the average consumer and the average home cook to start thinking like we think in restaurants in terms of food waste and how to get the most out of things. So I think that as hard as this is for all of us right now, it does present an opportunity for us to really think about how to use ingredients in different ways, how to have no scrap and no waste. And that's something we really focus on in the restaurants for the sake of the planet, the sake of respecting the ingredients in the food, but also just for our bottom line. Like that's how we function anyway. I dig through trash cans at the restaurant.
To do what?
Well, to find scraps. Like I'll find like new cooks who don't consider the impact of throwing something away. And so anyone who's been with me for a while don't try those games. But
so you're checking up to see.
I will dig. You know, if I see like a really conveniently placed paper towel or something over a trash can, I will lift it up and go in and see what's in there. So, we'll just have a conversation about we don't throw those things away.
I'm laughing about that for a couple of reasons. Kind of both funny ha-ha and funny ironic. So part of the reason that this has been on my mind, Tiffany, is so I have a 17-year-old who's about to go to college for music, wants mm-hmm. to be a professional musician,
awesome.
Has also gotten very interested in cooking,
mm.
and has been saying to me, Mom, I want to be a professional musician, which yep. means I will not anticipate having very much money.
I think musicians and chefs can kind of live in the same world where it's like you don't make any money until maybe someday you make a little and you can do well.
Well, so this is what said the paper towel partly made me think of it because I'm always telling him you do not need to use 7 paper towels to dry your hands.
One will do it.
Exactly. But also because I was thinking about your ranch chicken. Like one of the things we talked to you about early on.
I owe Titus and Marquise ranch chicken. Every time I walk in, I know they're like where's the
ranch chicken? And that's something you used
will
to make.
It, so I know Marquise is behind us like, where's the chicken?
Our senior technical director is like waving at Tiffany through the glass like, where's my ranch chicken?
I'm not walking in this building without ranch chicken ever again. I promise.
It's something that you made in college.
Yeah.
And it kind of represents that cooking on a budget that
yeah.
I think we think people like you never did, but
right.
you did.
Everyone has done it. I think, yeah, I didn't come out of the womb making like, you know, seared foie gras. That's how it works. I grew up with really humble means. Like my mom was a dump cook. Everything started and ended with a can of cream of chicken soup.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were a military family that was on a really, really tight budget all the time. So, I learned to like make a lot out of a little, which is, I think, what we do when you come up without like extraordinary means and my mom was, you know, she grew up Southern and there's the idea of wasting food because for the most part, they grew a lot of their own. You don't grow your own food and waste it. You know what I mean? You understand the cycle of like all the work that it takes, the care, the, you know, understanding with weather cycles and, you know, hyper sort of climates and all the things that affect, you know, just a sizable garden in your backyard. You know, you know what works and what doesn't, and you don't always have the luxury of everything growing well. So there's the idea of waste doesn't happen. You just don't do it.
So I have two questions for you. You can answer them in either order that you want,
mm-hmm.
right? So one question is a tip for avoiding food waste that you've become sort of a master at that other people may not think about? And then the, well, let's just do that one.
Okay. I'll give a couple. So any sort of meat scraps end up in a stock for me.
Interesting.
And so I'll make like even like veg scraps, meat scraps, they will all go in a stock. And so I'll just make stock at home and then I put them in ice cube trays or little like handleable containers that don't, they're not giant. So if I just need a little, I can do that. I will also make pestos out of like any leftover greens or like the butt of lettuce or whatever it might be. I'll cut it up and make pestos or some sort of like green sauce out of it.
So with the stock, what goes with the meat scraps and the vegetable scraps to make it hearty?
Water.
That's it, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if I'm just making like a really simple stock, if it's not like a big beef stock, I'm really taking like all of my scraps for like, say I have, you know, carrot peelings and onion butts and celery or whatever, any sort of smashed garlic or whatever it might be, chicken carcasses. If there's, even if it's like I get a roasted chicken from the grocery store,
yeah,
I do not throw that carcass away. So I'll just simmer that with a good amount of like whatever I have for a veg and water. There's some conversation about like not letting your stocks be like cloudy and milky. Ignore all of that. It does not matter. I'm not looking for like clear stuff. I'm looking for like to use food and for it to be flavorful.
And are there any greens that you can't make pesto out of? Kale, spinach? I don't know. I'm making this up. But
yeah. It would be hard to think about one. Now, I like bitter greens, so I don't worry about bitterness in there. If it's, you know, spinach and romaine butts, is it going to be like the world's most like pungent or flavorful? Maybe not. So throw a little bit of like throw some parsley in there, throw whatever else you have in there. But no, I don't think that, I mean, some harder herbs I wouldn't throw in there, like rosemary or maybe even a little sage would be fine. No, I think you can make pesto out of almost anything.
So that, this ingredients list you just gave brings me to my second question. And we're speaking with Tiffany Faison. She's dropped by to say hello to us. And we're
talking
about. I love
being here with you guys.
We love so having nice. You. Like I said, it's good for my heart.
It's the same. It's like a beautiful little checkout for my day.
So the other thing that I wanted to ask you about in this is these substitutions, right? You've made a couple of references about key ingredients, and you said a little earlier in our conversation, you know, figuring out what that one ingredient is or how I can substitute something more affordable. Mm-hmm. Are there a handful of foods, herbs, et cetera, that are sort of, you can use this anywhere, it's affordable, stock this one?
There's a lot. I'll tell you what's typically in my fridge. And I think people think I have this, you know, like, like yeah. extensive. I don't.
I'm actually picturing this massive.
No,
you know?
It's just me. So I don't do that. And I'm really careful about how much I buy when I go to the grocery store. I'm frequently traveling. So I think a lot about what's going to be left in my fridge. For me, it is always, I'll get good greens, like some sort of salad greens where I always have that in my fridge. And if I'm eating salads, I will eat, you know, whatever it is, I'll make a salad out of. I'll save the rest of the greens. And if I'm, you know, I don't know, roasting a piece of salmon or chicken or whatever it is I'm doing, I will throw those greens in at the last minute, like the butts and like the scraps and stuff, and just wilt them with whatever it is that I'm cooking. I always have garlic. I always have onions, just in
case.
Fresh
garlic.
Fresh garlic, fresh onions, always. I usually have thyme. It's hearty and it doesn't wilt very easily, and it's great for roasting chicken, roasting salmon, like, you know, accenting any sort of greens that you're cooking. It's really can be used with so many things. It's great. Cilantro, parsley usually, and I use both the stems and the leaves. I love the stems. They're my favorite part. Yep. It's almost like having like herb caviar. It pops in your mouth. It's super delicious and lovely. For me, like little cherry tomatoes almost always. And if I don't eat them all, if I know that I'm like on my way out, I will just throw them in eggs in the morning or whatever it might be. They're easy to eat, or I'll take them, like put them in a bag and take them on the plane with me and just have a little snack.
Yeah. All of that sounds delicious.
Yeah. Eggs always. I mean, lately it's like $40 for
eggs are so expensive.
Eggs. Yeah. Well, we had an avian flu, so that's not, it's like a perfect confluence of a bunch of things, right? So that's not just like normal inflation. It's that flu that just really wiped out like such a significant population of chickens in the United States. So, which anytime that happens, I always think about how we're farming, what we're doing, and we just needs to change.
All right. I want to look ahead now into 2023. And to do that, I'm going to look behind. So back in November, we did a Friendsgiving.
I still think about
with
it.
With you. I do too.
So great.
And I loved everything about it, including confession time here, that pizza that you brought that was a turkey terrific. I actually think about that thing like every day.
Okay.
Sometime every day when I think about that. And of course, you made that up. And so I'm wondering, what are you excited about making up or experimenting with in 2023? What's the new Tiffany dish or item that you're kind of excited about?
I think there's kind of two worlds for me. So things that I'm working on developing professionally. We are doing a sandwich pop-up at Dive Bar in the month of March. And so we have a bunch of like fun different sandwiches. I love sandwiches.
I do too.
I'm such a, like, a good sandwich is an art. And you can't, you know, you can make your own sandwich, but a bologna sandwich made by anyone else will taste better than a gourmet sandwich made for myself by me. Do you know what I mean? I just think it's like, it's part of those like rules of life. Like someone else making you a sandwich is so much better than any other sandwich
you can make. It's the love they put into
it. It is. So working on sandwich pop-ups, there's some really creative stuff that we're working on for that. And then like, we made a turkey sandwich that has like fried pickles in it. It's the best turkey sandwich I've ever had. It was wild. We worked on that yesterday. Working on more creative pizzas and just like continuing to work, you know, think about new ingredients for pizzas at Tenderoni's. And pushing that. Personally, I like to pick areas of the world where my depth of knowledge is not as deep or vast as it should be. So, right now I'm working on South Indian cooking and I'm also working on North African cooking.
Awesome. All right. Now, a couple of other things. One, any shout outs you want to give to chefs or restaurants this month around Boston?
The long list for the Beard Awards was just released.
That's right.
So we've got some Northeast people on the list, which is great. So really excited for all of them. My friend Leanne Wong, not regional, but she has been cooking in Hawaii forever and ever and ever. Just quietly like grinding and doing her thing, really largely uncelebrated. And she finally made the long list. So I'm thrilled for her.
That's really exciting.
It's always great to see like our stars from New England on those lists. So yeah, those are my shout outs for now.
All right. And you and I want us to tell people how they can join us next Monday night.
I'm so excited.
We're going to be together at WBUR City
Space. We have a whole hour together.
This
is going to be lots of fun. And you can ask me almost anything.
Excellent.
So we are going to be at WBUR City Space, which if you have not been, friends, it is stunning. It's beautiful.
Space.
So we're going to sit and chat about all things food and culture and whatever it is you want to ask me. Open book, AMA. And then we're going to have some little noshes in the lobby and hang out with friends.
And they'll be gorgeous and delicious. Yes. And it starts at 6:30 Monday night, WBUR City Space. For more information and to get tickets, you can go to WBUR.org/events. She's even more dynamic in person. You should come join us. Tiffany Faison.
You're so good to me.
Thanks, and I'll see you again Monday night.
I know. It's date night Monday night, you and me.
There you go. Today, we bring you our fourth installment of Set in Boston, which is that series where we watch and talk about films that are set in or are about Boston. We did the latest, The Departed, on a 35mm film at Brookline's Coolidge Corner Theater with a couple hundred of our closest friends. 2006's The Departed. It's a gritty, sort of obscene version of a Hong Kong film called Infernal Affairs. In the story, two police officers are undercover. One's working for Boston's Irish mob, one is working for the Massachusetts State Police, and both are trying to figure out who the other one is while keeping their bosses happy and alive. Now, the film won 4 Oscars, including Best Picture, and the only Best Directing Oscar for Martin Scorsese, who's been nominated for that award more than any other living director. Dominga Martin, Ty Burr, and Casey Sherman watched the film with us and then joined us in front of a live audience at the Coolidge after the film. Dominga's an award-winning local filmmaker whose work has aired on BET, VH1, MTV Music, Grammy.com, and her first short film premiered at the Roxbury Film Festival. Now, Ty Burr is a film critic and the creator of the Substack e-newsletter Ty Burr's Watchlist. He helped us launch Set in Boston here on the show. And Casey Sherman, local screenwriter and best-selling author of The Finest Hours, Boston Strong, and a book he co-authored with Dave Wedge, Hunting Whitey, the inside story of the capture and killing of America's most wanted crime boss. As we talked, I started by asking Ty Burr if this film, The Departed, still holds up 17 years later.
Yes, I think it looks pretty much exactly the way it looked in 2006. I don't even think Martin Scorsese thinks it's his best film. I think he's very happy it's the one that won him an Oscar. It's a very good film. It's a very good genre film.
I think
he'd
have been happy with any of them winning an Oscar.
But my point is, it doesn't feel like as personal as some of his other films. And in fact, it was a difficult film for him to make, especially apparently in post-production. He really struggled with it. That said, to me, this is the peak of the Boston noir genre of the early part of the new century. You know, following Mystic River, following Gone Baby Gone, all of that movies. This, I think, is kind of the high watermark of the genre before it starts turning into parody, before it starts becoming, you know, Boston movie, you know, like we saw it on late night TV. I think everything pretty much works here, and yet it's also right at the edge of becoming a little cliche. And I, you know, when, as I was sitting in the audience and hearing people laugh appreciably, but also at some of the over-the-top nature of some of the movie, I think that's what's kind of changed with time. We kind of see where it gets a little almost too operatic in places, or too sort of comic book violent.
Pick it up from there, Dominga.
Well, I have to be honest, this is not my favorite Martin Scorsese film or Boston film, but what I anticipated when this came out was Mark Wahlberg and Matt Damon being in a film together mm-hmm. for the first time. I think looking back at it now, I did enjoy it, but the derogatory language alone is a crime in this film now, right? Great acting. Some of my favorite actors are in this movie. And your question is, does it stand the test of time? It did feel operatic in moments. I didn't even think it was a funny film. But because of the cliche and because it's not, it has some nuances that Boston films have. Like some of my favorite directors who make Boston movies are Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, The Gone Baby Gone's, The Mystic River, Patriot's Day. It's one of my favorites. This was not, but I did enjoy it. Now.
So, you know, I am imagining that we'll have listeners who will hear this tomorrow who didn't just watch the film and maybe have never seen the film. So for those listeners, this is the story of one state trooper in Massachusetts who goes undercover in a gang led by Jack Nicholson, and a police officer who's a bad guy who's undercover for Jack Nicholson inside the Massachusetts State Police. Casey, as I was watching it this time, and I have many thoughts about the film that we just watched, I found myself thinking, okay, so what's possible in this film? And we'll get to the Whitey connections or lack thereof.
No, there are a lot of Whitey connections
okay.
In this story. But is it possible, I think, is the question, right? Everything is possible. I've been covering organized crime here in Boston for 30 years. And what you saw on the screen really happened in many ways. Go back to, does this film stand up after so many years? And you know, the first thing I think of, God, those flip phones. You know, everybody was using flip phones in the film, and you look at it now and you think that's ancient history, as is the language that when you hear it, you know, that first scene is very jarring. And I didn't remember it being as jarring in 2006 when I saw it, as opposed to 2023 when we're rewatching it. Now that's kind of a reflection of where the city was back in the, you know, the bad old days. We have come a long way since then, but from an organized crime angle, yes, it's very over the top, but so was the gang war in Boston from the 1960s all the way up to the early 1990s, when you had over 157 men and women killed in a gang war, which was the bloodiest gang war in American history.
So I want to hit a couple of points there. You know, the first is, again, for those who weren't with us tonight and seeing the film, the opening scene is of the riots in 1974 around busing in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, well covered in the book Common Ground, and then actually, interestingly, very well covered over the summer in a play called Common Ground Revisited by Kirsten Greenidge. And it is interesting, Ty, that this film, it's not just the language, and it's not just, and I'm just going to say it, that the only female character who has any dimension sleeps with everyone, right? It's not just
as psychiatrists do.
Yeah. But this film is literally...
She literally should have her license revoked like 5 minutes into this movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's problematic, right? But this film is literally rooted in racism. This film is rooted, it is framed, it is opened, and it is originated and situated in racism, Ty. And I
saw that differently, sitting here as a white woman, I saw that differently than I did when I saw it the first time in 2006, 2007, 2008.
Well, I do think the conversation is among white Bostonians is different than it was 15 years ago, 16 years ago. No, how many years ago?
17.
Okay.
The film came out in 2006.
I think the shocking nature of that and the honesty of it, honestly, you know, that first line that, you know, Damon says to Anthony Anderson, you know, you're a black guy in Boston, you don't need my help to be completely
blanked.
That comes from the screenwriter William Monahan, who is a son of Dorchester, and I think had very few illusions about the city and its racial inequalities and a lot of the people he grew up with. And I remember seeing this movie in 2006 and kind of going, whoa, somebody's telling the truth. It's something that really, we still have trouble acknowledging. And I think, you know, you have one black character in the movie and you could go in that direction further, but that's not what this movie is about. Although it's there, it's part of the backdrop, it's part of the language. It's actually one of the things I think that makes this film feel real and honest in a scuzzy, nasty way that is truthful. You know, the history of Boston movies, and I've written a lot about the history of Boston movies, is very much not about addressing the racial situation in Boston. I do think the great Boston movie would be about the busing era, and it will never, ever be made because everybody here is afraid to make it.
So let's touch on filmmaking. Casey, part of the reason that I had said maybe based in Whitey Bulger, maybe not, is because, as one of the audience members shouted out, there was a Hong Kong film called Infernal Affairs.
Right.
That is this plot that came out before The Departed. In fact, Brad Pitt and another Hollywood figure optioned the rights to that film, and it was eventually turned into The Departed. So the core story is actually rooted, right, in a different story, and then a series of choices to bring it to Boston, which bring the Boston pieces in.
Which brings a lot of the Boston pieces in, and you know that this is the mythology of Whitey Bulger that Whitey Bulger wanted the world to see, not necessarily the FBI informant part of that, because for his entire life, despite the facts that we all know, he always insisted he wasn't an FBI informant. But, you know, Frank Costello is based on Whitey Bulger. Billy Monahan utilized a lot of that Boston noir lore of the 1980s, the 1970s, to weave it in and really to make the story The Departed and to separate it from the previous inclination, you know, that was in the Hong Kong genre.
So Dominga, now, as a filmmaker, we know those choices
yes.
are made, right? And you talked about some of not your favorite Scorsese film, a little bit operatic, some great acting. As a filmmaker, what were the choices you noticed tonight that stood out to you the most in the film?
Well, let me bring it back for a second for one of the reasons why I was so disappointed. Because I like the story. I'm fascinated with the historical aspect of the Winter Hill Gang. And I wanted the filmmaker to just get to it. Why not call him Whitey or Bulger? And so I wanted that moment for me as a filmmaker. Now to answer your question, what's missing in all of these Boston stories is the black perspective, right? This is a very racist city. Former mayor said that racism here is a public health crisis. Right? We all
Boston
know.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who's now the Labor
yeah,
Secretary.
Yes. We all know that it's very difficult as black creatives in this city. I can speak from lived experience about that. Very seldom do you have professional writers who work in Hollywood that are from here. You have a few, a handful. But those stories are not, that perspective is not shown. For example, Steve, the rifleman Fleming, grew up in Orchard Park. Where I grew up, where New Edition grew up, where Donna Summers' family grew up. But you don't hear those stories in the history in any of those movies. So as a filmmaker, I would say what's missing in all of them is us.
And was there anything that stuck out to you in the film that felt particularly strong or unique? This is this film. This is why it captured the imagination of the people at the time. You know, I don't want to lose in looking at it wide-eyed. Best picture, mm-hmm. best director, filled a theater here, right? 17 years after it was released. What did you see any moments of greatness in the film as a filmmaker?
Well, the movie is great. It won Best Picture because of the acting. It's phenomenal acting. Don't you all think that it was amazing acting in this film? Martin Scorsese is a legend, right? So there was nothing particularly wrong about the film. It's just that it was a film that alluded to Whitey Bulger, and I just think that they should not have avoided that. Maybe that was some licensing issues of a reason why.
Well, Whitey Bulger was still on the run,
right?
You know, while you know, when this movie actually premiered, and Whitey Bulger did see this film the day that it premiered in 2006 in San Diego, and I wrote about that in my book Hunting Whitey. But I think you're absolutely right when it's, you know, it's really kind of one viewpoint into the city, as opposed to a lot of different viewpoints and angles and perspectives. And I think Scorsese could have added more texture to that story. You know, the few minority characters really kind of stand out because they didn't have much to do besides the female psychiatrist, as you said, Ty, you slept with everybody in the film. But I do think that the performances stand out. I'm a big sucker for Boston gangster films, going all the way back to The Friends of Eddie Coyle and Robert Mitchum, which was a great film.
The first film we did and set in Boston.
Excellent. If you guys haven't seen it, watch it. You know, the dialogue and the accents are really original and clear and very true to this place. But, you know, Departed is, it's rooted in truth, but it's operatic. And I do think, Ty, to your point, it created this stereotype of Boston gangster. When you come to Boston, immediately you hear, you know, Stepping Up to Boston and all right. of the right. different tropes that we now look back on 15, 17 years later as a joke.
Right. Ironically, Scorsese is, we think of him as a New York filmmaker.
Right.
And I think it's funny that some of the best Boston films have been made by New Yorkers. I'm thinking of The Verdict, which was made by Sidney Lumet, who is like, you know, the quintessential New York director. But there are places here where I feel like, oh yeah, this is made by somebody who isn't from here. And there are other places where I feel like, ooh, somebody here, somebody in this production lives here. And
so give an example of each.
Honestly, with Monahan's script, the language, the slurs, the particular slurs are very much particular to Boston. I remember, you know, hearing stuff like that growing up. The fact that somebody says, oh, it's out on 128. Somebody from out of town would say it's out on Route 95. If you say 128, you're from here. At the same time, there are aspects of the film that could take place anywhere. You know, you take away the accents, you take away the Bulger stuff. It's still a pretty standard genre, crisscross kind of movie. Very Baroque, very well constructed. And sometimes I think Scorsese is more interested in dropping in little bits of film history because he loves that. The X's throughout the movie that he's lifted from Scarface. The shower, the shot of the shower head that's right out of Psycho.
Right.
The Madeline walking toward the camera at the end straight out of The Third Man. I think sometimes that's what jazzes him more than the tropes that we're talking about.
Right. So go ahead, Dominga.
To Ty's point, what I'll say as a writer, they did have someone from Boston in the writer's room because nuance, right? The way that we speak. Bostonians say cold cuts. You're a worker.
Yeah.
We love saying you're a worker. Supper. Some of us still say tonic instead of soda. So those are the things that stuck out to me as a Bostonian that they got right.
But I do think that Monahan slips a little bit. You know, again, I think a lot of the actors probably brought a lot of that dialogue into the script. When Monahan's saying down Providence and up Gloucester, I've lived in South Boston for 20 years. You know, when I was in college and a young professional, nobody talks that way in Southie. They don't. You know, this is Monahan trying to be, a classic screenwriter and elevating this to literature beyond the, you know, organized crime genre that he was writing in.
So let's talk a little bit about guns and drugs. And I would argue just in my perception watching it, right, guns were a character
in this film?
It's partly the time it's made. It's partly the film's roots in Hong Kong action films. That's in the
DNA.
That's
in the DNA. Affairs.
That's absolutely in the DNA, and you can't take it out. Sometimes I look at this movie and think, oh, it's not about undercover cops. It's about the perfect headshot. You know, it looks like they really put a lot of thought okay. into how blood sprays.
I was going to say, by headshot, you don't mean actors.
No. I mean somebody getting shot in
shot
the head.
Shot to the head.
They really choreograph that in a way that I think probably jazz them from a craft point of view, but sticks out now as, again, I think partially intentionally over the top and operatic. But does it reflect, a larger obsession in this country with guns? Well, yeah, sure. Every movie made by Hollywood pretty much does that. I actually think this is a little more the way the omnipresence of shooting in this movie really comes from Infernal Affairs.
So you really see that as the lineage that we can one
yeah.
of the pieces of
yeah,
lineage.
Yeah,
we can
yeah,
really
yeah. I think it's actually probably the most clear lineage from that movie.
Although I will say, because I watched Infernal Affairs last night, right, to get ready for tonight, there are also scenes that are almost frame for frame.
Yes.
The same.
That's right.
As they are in The Departed.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I think the Hong Kong action genre, John Woo, Scorsese had a lot of respect for John and certainly brought a lot of his storytelling and, visual operatics into his filmmaking. You know, you look at John Wick and those films today, it's comic book violence. You know, the violence that we saw in The Departed, I can tell you that has really happened. I've seen the crime scene photos. I've been to those crime scenes. I know those types of shootings actually happen. So even though it was over the top, it was rooted in reality.
Does anyone who's not from Boston actually learn anything about Boston from watching this movie?
No.
Not to go to 344 Washington Street.
Casey, do you agree?
I think it's Boston is stereotypical Boston. This is the Boston they think that they know until they get here. But, again, when it came out and all the fanfare that was involved with it, I think any time that you can film a major movie here in Boston with that the host of the cast that they had, that's a positive, even though it does shine a negative light on a particular, chapter in Boston's history of crime. I thought that the film does stand up. I think that people around the country and the world love it. I've been all over the world, and they don't talk about the movies that I've been involved in. They talk about The Departed. Somebody in France gives me their best Boston accent, and I have to laugh, but that's the way they view it.
Last voice there, Casey Sherman, some of our conversation from last night's viewing of The Departed at the Coolidge Corner Theater. Sherman is a local screenwriter and best-selling author of books like The Finest Hours and, along with David Wedge, Hunting Whitey, the inside story of the capture and killing of America's most wanted crime boss. We also heard from Dominga Martin, an award-winning local filmmaker whose work has aired on BET, VH1, MTV Music and Grammy.com, and film critic Ty Burr, creator of the Substack e-newsletter Ty Burr's Watchlist. And he helped us launch Set in Boston on the show. We appreciate the support from the Coolidge last night and hope to bring you more live film out in the city of Boston. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. See you on Monday.